Before we get started, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and mind body coach in Los Angeles, and you might remember that she guest hosted my podcast back in January and actually came on live with me back in August of 2021. Jeannie facilitates breath work to decrease stress, release stuck negative emotions, and decrease pain. Are you having trouble calming the monkey mind? Well, she knows all about that. You see, it's not about controlling or managing your stress or your thoughts. Instead, it's about shifting and improving the relationship that you have with them. Jeannie spent 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and a myriad of other chronic symptoms that left her physically and mentally exhausted. She healed herself completely and is obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. Looking to decrease your negative self-talk, regulate your nervous system, and heal your TMS symptoms? You should reach out to her directly. Go to her website, www.jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieKulwin.com. Sign up for a free 30-minute consult so that you can get more info and see if it's a good fit for the two of you to work together. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, May the 25th, and before I get started, I wanted to make sure that I give a special shout-out to the patrons of the podcast. If you are enjoying this show and you want to help keep it on the air for free, the best thing that you can do is go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast to support the show. These are the people that have been donating month over month to continue to keep the show on the air. So Barb and Arnie and Brian and Julie, Ross, Christina, Anthony, Michael, Tony, Kelly, Irina, Mindy, Jason, John, James, Sylvie, Sasha, Dominic, Enda, Elise, Amanda, Paul, Brent, Emily, and Patricia. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast for all this time. So big treat on the show today. It's been over 3 years since he was on, but Dan Buglio from Pain For You, he is definitely one of the favorites out there, and he was doing this work long before I had even discovered Dr. Sarno or any of the stuff in there. So this guy comes to us with a boatload of knowledge that goes back years and years and years. So I'm excited for you to hear from him again. If you didn't hear us the first time, I think our last episode was like episode 70 or so. It was a long time ago. It was back in 2019. And so Dan kind of gives us a little bit of his insight that he's come to or has come to him since then. And we go into quite a bit of depth in those arenas. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the show. And here is Dan Buglio and I. Now, would you believe me if I said that almost on this day 3 years ago, Dan Buglio was on the podcast with me. It was May 15th, 2019. And at the end of that podcast, I said, hey, how about we have you back in 6 months and do another interview? And here we are, whatever 365 times 3 + 1 is. Dan is back. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Very hard to believe that it was 3 years ago. So the reason that this came up is that I had a relapse recently back in March, and we can get more into this if you'd like, but I was doing sort of the typical deep in the trenches TMS thing where I was starting to do way too much. And it was, some of it was going back and listening to some of my favorite podcasts, and that's where yours came up. And I was like, gosh, I said in 6 months, and then we haven't done anything. And then I messaged you, and here you are.
Well, I appreciate the invite, man. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, one thing I want to bring some attention to is that, so you continue to publish content. You have a great YouTube channel, and you have a great Facebook page. You have a good following, and you've been doing a daily video for, is it over 3 years at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is crazy.
About 1,150 days in a row, somewhere thereabouts, maybe a couple shy of that.
When has there ever been any day where you didn't put one out? Like, has the streak ever been broken?
Nope.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well,
now what I have done is recorded some success stories, and that will sometimes take the place of my daily talk.
Okay.
But I have uploaded and shared a video every single day since pretty much April 1st, 2019.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so I'm looking through, and actually it's interesting because so if you go to YouTube and you just type in "pain for you," you can find them all. But I went and I sorted. I was just curious on how far back it went. So I sorted first by date, and it's really, you know, and this just happens with people that are doing video content or anything creative, really, is you can see like the production value has dramatically changed, right? In the beginning, it was taken vertically on a cell phone probably. And then if you sort it by newest, now suddenly the camera's definitely different. There's graphics, there's all this kind of stuff. I'm curious though, like you've got these topics that you've been doing for 1150 days. How do these topics come to you? Like, typically, how do you get an idea fly in your head where you're like, oh, I'm going to make a video about this today?
Generally, from all the communication I have with the people in the audience, mm-hmm. you know, there's probably 80 comments a day. And inevitably, sometimes there's a 3-word, 5-word term in their comment or in my response that I go, oh, there's a video.
Yeah.
And so I literally have a to-do list manager on my phone that also syncs to my computer. And anytime I get a topic idea, I just kind of type it in, you know, and probably have hundreds of them in there now that many of them, you know, I look back and I go, it wasn't really a good idea. But I can just kind of scroll through there in about 3 minutes,
yeah.
pick a topic. I either go to the backyard or to the couch. I hit record on the camera and say, well, today's topic is this. And I start talking. That's about how much preparation goes into each video. I don't sit down with a, you know, a whiteboard and map out 18 bullet points that I want to cover. I don't do a lot of deep research. This is all kind of off the cuff topics just based on doing this stuff all day, every day for many years.
Now you live in Pennsylvania. Is that right? It's beautiful wherever it is that you live.
Yeah. It's about 25 miles north of Philadelphia in a place called Bucks County. So yeah, it's gorgeous.
So when we looking back, and I would encourage you that if you haven't heard this, the first podcast that Dan and I did together, go back. It's episode 70. It's from again, May 15th, 2019. And I was kind of looking for like buzzwords, like what was some of the stuff that Dan was talking about then? Cause I'm always very curious on people that come back, especially after a certain amount of time, what are some themes maybe that they were talking about then and kind of where do they sit with them now? And there was this word that you had kept using a lot during the interview. And it's something that there, since we did our interview, mm-hmm. there's actually been great research that has been published on the topic of neuroplasticity. And you'd said at the time you were just sure. really nerding out on it. So over the last 3 years, I guess maybe give me some of the big insights or takeaways on this that you know, you kind of keep coming back to as something to sure. think about and something to consider in that realm.
Well, I mean, neuroplasticity is just what our brain does. It's how it forms new connections, remembers things. And, you know, when we shift our focus away from a certain topic long enough, it lets go of those connections, right? And my analogy is always about, you know, I had to learn Spanish in high school and I took 2 years of it. And had I not, you know, learned and graduated, my dad was going to hand me my ass if I didn't graduate. So I learned Spanish and my brain created these neuroplastic connections in my brain to remember Spanish. Now, as soon as I graduated high school, I didn't have to surgically cut those wires. I just basically shifted my attention towards college, playing music, and whatever else was on my mind at the time. And all on its own, my brain let go of these neuroplastic connections. I didn't have to do anything proactive to forget Spanish. And so pain is the same way. The more attention, the more fear we have surrounding the pain, the more likely the brain's going to say, this is important, let's wire it. Which is why so much of my approach is accurate knowledge to dial down the fear so we can take the attention away from the pain or symptoms. And then, you know, let's dial down the fear. You know, accurate knowledge dials down the fear so that we can now turn our attention away from it so that the brain can do what it does, which is say, this is no longer important anymore. Now, for a while, I probably got a little bit geeky and was like, okay, we got to rewire our brain. I literally just did a video a few days ago that said, do we need to rewire our brain? And my current take on it is, we don't have to do it, but the brain's going to do it if we focus on the right stuff. So we don't have to do anything proactive. There's tons of rewiring programs in the TMS mind-body space. Rewire this, fix that, you know, lots of them. And I think, in my estimation, some of that stuff is a little bit overcomplicating it. We've never in our lives, Eddie, had to focus on the wiring in our brain to do anything. I mean, you're a sports guy. You know, did you ever have to wire your brain in order to swing a baseball bat?
Basketball? Well, it's funny that you bring this up, and actually funny that even funnier that you use the analogy of baseball. I coach youth girls soccer, 7 and 8 mm-hmm. year olds, and I've been racking my brain. How can I essentially help them build the skills to get better? And I was telling a friend of mine that when I was a kid and I did my first year of Little League, I was thinking about motivation and what could motivate a little kid to want to get better. And for me, it was entirely about playing my very first year of Little League, not doing well at all. And in the very last game, I had a double, got thrown out at third, trying for a triple. But it was literally that, just like that instant sense of like, God, that felt great. It was a rush to go and have that experience. And so in the off season, I had a pitch back in my backyard, and every day for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever, all I did was throw the ball at the pitch back, field it, throw the ball at the pitch back, field it. But I wasn't, you know, if you'd have asked me when I was 9 years old or 10 years old, hey, are you rewiring? I wouldn't have known what you were talking about, but that's what it was. It was the repetition.
Yeah. And so my point is, you know, I've kind of come full circle. Initially, I was like, wow, this neuroplasticity stuff, it explains how the brain learns to keep the pain going. But how it learns, let's focus on what the body's actually doing, what the brain's actually doing, and then work with it. Well, if the brain wires the things that we focus on the most, then if we want it to get rid of the pains or symptoms, let's focus on it less or least. And the brain will automatically manage the wiring for us. But anytime you're proactively thinking about brain wiring, I think you're overcomplicating it and actually putting the attention on the thing that you want to go away. That would have been like me speaking Spanish every day in an attempt to forget it.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. So that's why all of these fixing activities, and I know there's wonderful people out there, but every TMS program has their thing. It's like, well, let's do the journaling, the meditation, the somatic tracking, the pain reprocessing therapy. Let's observe the pain from a neutral standpoint. These things are all useful tools. But if you're doing them for 2 hours a day, all you're doing is staring at the pain going, did it work yet? Did it work yet? Did it work yet? And then wondering why it hasn't. So, you know, I've really kind of come full circle. And we go all the way back to Dr. Sarno's original statement as he would dismiss people from his office in New York City. I've literally talked to like a dozen people who have been to see him in New York City in the 90s. And he said, oh, yeah, Dr. Sarno, when I was done with the office visit, he said, now go live your life. There's nothing wrong with you. And that, you know, hearing that over and over and over again really was like, well, what are we fixing then?
Yeah.
Why do we have all these programs that require anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours a day to rewire things and fix things and brain training, amygdala retraining, you know, nervous system dysregulation, soothing? And well, isn't that a lot of fixing activities that just convinces the brain that we must be really messed up if we're doing all this strange stuff to fix ourselves? So I've come for full circle, which is all about you're not broken. Focus on living your life. Show the brain, teach the brain that you're okay by not making this your number one priority. And it seems to be working really well with my clients.
So that's my next question. So you work with clients privately, and I kind of always have my finger on the pulse. I'm trying to watch, you know, when people look for a recommendation of what's a video, what's a resource, what's a this, your name inevitably, I mean, beyond like a Dr. Sarno or even like a Schubiner book or something like that, your name is usually in the mix of the first 3 or 4 or 5 names that I see that get mentioned. So when you're talking about And maybe this is difficult to define, but what are a couple of things that you advise, you know, you're talking to somebody for the first time or the second time or whatever, what are a couple of things that you advise them to do immediately? Like go out and do what? I don't want to say that you're anti-program, but what are some things for somebody to do that's sitting there with pain? They're aware of Sarno stuff and TMS and they believe it, at least, you know, at least they say they believe it. What are you advising them to do?
Yeah, I mean, if we were to take somebody who's kind of brand new to the concept, the first thing they have to do is figure out what this TMS mind-body stuff is. I've now been calling it perceived danger pain because I kind of believe that's exactly what turns on pain, yeah, is the perception of danger. So I really say education is the first thing. It has to be the foundation that you build the rest of the practice on, right? Because if you don't know what's going on, you're going to be terrified of the fact that you've got symptoms or pains or sensations. So understanding what is going on is an extremely useful tool to dial down the fear. Because once you know that what's going on and that this is the brain creating the pain in response to something it perceives as dangerous, then you're like, then you can get to that aha moment where you say, holy crap, I'm really not broken. My body's actually okay. Despite what the doctors say, the imaging studies, the medical diagnoses, what it really means is if you go through the assessments and determine that you have TMS or this perceived danger pain, then it really means your body's not the problem. Those are normal abnormalities, as Sarno talked about decades ago. And so that's got to be foundational. As far as what to do next, once you have the knowledge and you really have the confidence that this absolutely applies to me, then the next step is really to teach your brain that you're okay. So my approach, as I work with my private clients, and Eddie, I don't know if you know it, but I also have a group coaching program where I have Zoom calls on Wednesdays, one at 1 in the afternoon, one at 7 p.m. Eastern. And, you know, I've got anywhere between 30 to 45 people showing up.
Wow.
And it's all about just drilling the fundamentals, helping people get clear. It's more of a, let's share our positive experiences. So any wins, any successes, and then drill on the fundamentals. You know, you got questions, we'll answer them. If you're doubtful as to what's going on, we'll break that down in the middle of the coaching call while other people watch. And, you know, these calls run anywhere from 2 to 3 hours every single week. So I'm getting a lot of firsthand feedback that these concepts are working. People are doing things that they haven't done in years or decades. Just by adopting this I'm not broken mentality, dialing down the fear and starting to resume more and more activities. So, you know, it's not about going, in my opinion, it's not about going and finding this long-lost repressed emotion, as Sarno certainly indicated in his books. That may have been what started it, but 6 years later, the fact that you're still in pain may have much more to do with the fact that you learned to be afraid of movement and bending over than it was the emotional chaos 6 years ago. So my process doesn't really involve going and digging up the past. My process is teach yourself that emotions are safe by feeling the right now stuff. Teach yourself that you're safe physically by not walking around in a tight, tense body that you're doing shallow breathing in all day. Teach yourself that your own thoughts are not dangerous by not taking them so seriously. You know, choose your response to the pain, because if you're freaking out every time you sense the pain or the symptoms, you're basically screaming to the brain, we're in danger. And the brain's not going to calm down and turn things off. So how we respond to the pain is huge. So, I mean, I've given you like a couple of touch points, but the overall message is, how do we teach ourself and our overprotective brain that we're really not in danger? Well, if we can prove that we're emotionally safe, physically safe, and mentally safe, doesn't that go a long way towards turning off these danger signals called pain?
What would you say after working with so many clients over the years, in different capacities, like if you had to give me, I mean, say that you take on, say you have experience with 20 clients and, for whatever reason, they're just there's blockage there. They can't seem to just get past their issues. What would you say are maybe a couple of overarching themes that that are maybe reason for blocks? Like, because I would imagine that as complicated as maybe people think getting over this stuff is, it really is very simple. Not to say that it's easy, but it is fairly correct. Simple. What are a couple of things that people are looking past maybe they're overlooking, reasons that in your observation you have seen?
Yeah, I mean, so I get a lot of people who are coming to me saying, Dan, I don't get it. I've been doing this practice, that practice, that practice. I meditate, I journal, I even go to therapy. I go to a TMS therapist. I've been seeing them for 6 months. I'm still not better. And my first question is, why do you think you hurt? Well, I think TMS is involved, but, you know, I got a bum foot with, you know, a neuroma on it. And I, you know, my immediate response is, well, then you don't believe your pain is from TMS. So how's your brain ever going to turn off the pain if you think you've got a bum foot, for example?
Yeah.
Right? Because the purpose of pain, Eddie, you know this, is to protect you from something your brain thinks is dangerous. Period. You touch a hot stove. The brain's saying, what are you doing? You're touching metal. The stove's been on. Get your hand off before you melt your skin. So the pain makes a decision to turn on the pain as a warning signal. And inevitably, 9 times out of 10, that warning signal works. Because we look at our hand, we go, oh, good, I'm not burnt. Where's the pain? It's already gone.
Yeah.
It's a warning signal. Pain is always a warning signal from the brain that something's dangerous. Like in my case, you know, I had like 13 years worth of back pain and sciatica. Most of my acute onsets were when I was bending over, you know, bend over to the desk to pick something up or pick up a laundry basket, or how it all started for me, bending over to put on my underwear of all things. So what did my brain learn? Bending over is dangerous. What do you think my brain did every time I'd bend over to pick something up? It would make it hurt as a warning to go stop that. That's dangerous. So if the brain is simply making decisions to turn on the pain to protect us from a perceived danger, the solution is teaching the brain that these things are not dangerous. So to answer your question, I'm sorry to dance around that. One of the biggest things that hold people back is lack of clarity. They still think their body's the problem. And with that lack of clarity, there's going to be a massive amount of fear. So it all goes back to foundation. You got to get really clear on what this human body and brain and, you know, the pain system is all about, what it's doing. And once you understand what's going on, you can then determine, is my pain or symptoms behaving like TMS, or is it behaving like a structural problem? And inevitably, just an example is somebody's like, oh, I feel great until noon, but then it really goes downhill. So how did your herniated disc take a break in the morning? How is that possible? Were you active in the morning? Yeah. So why does it wait till noon? You know what I mean? And there's a lot of inconsistencies in how pain behaves.
Yeah.
And that indicates that this is a brain-created issue based on the brain's conditioning. They expect to hurt in the afternoon, but hey, we're pretty good in the morning, or vice versa. So there's a lot of characteristics of how pain or symptoms behave that are not just clues that the brain is creating all this stuff, but actual hard proof. You know, so gain knowledge, do the assessments to say, how are my symptoms behaving? And if they're behaving like TMS, then they are TMS. Because a structural problem doesn't take a break. It just doesn't. It doesn't go on holiday when you go on vacation.
Yeah.
Inevitably, you've heard those stories. Somebody goes on vacation. I felt great all week. Then I got home. I started hurting. Okay. It ain't your body then. You know?
Well, I remember like when I was kind of in the crux of it. Because if you would have said that exact same thing to me when I was kind of in... There was this period of a few months where I hurt all the time. I would hurt when I first started working out. And then meaning like, let's say it's a 1 hour session for the first 10 or 15 minutes, it was brutal. And then I would seemingly be okay. And mm-hmm. then I'd finish and then I'd wrap it up and then workout would be over and I'd go back to doing whatever I needed to do for that day. And then I would be in an enormous amount of pain again. And so if you said that to me, I would have said something along the lines of, well, I'm warmed up, my fascia's warm, my joints are lubricated now, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like for you, a lot of this is kind of a sell job, right? Like being able to sell the concept of, you know, there's not really a rhyme or reason behind the TMS pain stuff, that the waxing and the waning and the appearing sometimes and the not appearing sometimes, like that stuff isn't logical. Do you find any sort of correlation? Like, I don't know, maybe the longer the person's been in pain, the harder they find it to believe that kind of stuff? Or do you not really see any sort of a correlation on when you're having to spend an amount of time, you know, kind of convincing someone to get out of their own head?
Well, you know, when you say there's no rhyme or reason, I'll go back to your example. When you first start lifting weights, your brain says, oh no, he's doing it again, and turns up the pain in an attempt to get you to stop. About 15 minutes into it, it says, he seems to be okay. I guess we're all right. But then later, you know, you're done working out, and then the brain goes, uh-oh, he worked out. Look, a lot of people can go on a walk and they'll be fine, but they hurt afterwards and maybe for a day or two later.
Yeah.
Oh, I created a flare. I did too much. I walked too far. Or I went out in the garden and I did some things and I felt okay while I was out there, but boy, did I hurt later. I must have overdone it. How does that make sense? Injuries are felt in the moment that they happen. I mean, you've had legitimate sports injuries. They hurt when they happen.
Yep.
You break a bone, it hurts that instant. So why is it that people can go out and exercise, in some cases vigorously, and they're perfectly fine while exercising, but yet the next day they've got all sorts of delayed reaction onset of this TMS mind-body pain? It's all based on perceived danger. I think there's a lot that has to do, Eddie, with the nervous system and the brain being highly vigilant. So what happens the day after you do a workout? You've got normal muscle fatigue, soreness. But to a person who is hypervigilant and their nervous system is amplifying everything, their nervous system at a subconscious level goes, I feel sore. Uh-oh, what happened? We overdid it. And then the thinking brain comes along and says, oh my God, we overdid it, did too much. What happened there? The danger level escalated, and what happens as a result? The pain flares up. I don't think it had anything to do with the workout, because if it was, it would have been hurting during the workout. So I like the perceived danger aspect to this, because it explains almost every scenario you can throw at me.
What if you were to sort of simplify or break down maybe almost like a blueprint of, you know, somebody bumps into you at a party or an elevator or a bar or whatever, and they say, Dan, what are the three things that people need to understand in order to get better? What do they need to do? Like, that's a phrase that Sarno used in All the Rage. Here's what you need to understand in order to get better. And he would say it to you. What are maybe the, you know, three simplified things that you would say as the expert?
Well, certainly clarity as to what's going on, like what causes pain. Confidence that applies to you, because without those two things, you're dead in the water. And then the last of it is, you know, consistently calming yourself. Right. You know, we hear a lot of, you know, things in the TMS community about self-talk, affirmations, all that kind of stuff. That's a heck of a lot easier if you have the clarity as to what exactly causes pain, how it works, and that this perceived danger pain or TMS applies to me. Because if I know that my body's okay, boy, it's going to be a heck of a lot easier to believe it when I say, hey, relax, it's okay. You're lifting some weights. The brain is just overcautious, trying to protect you by keeping you from doing this, by turning up the pain. And I see people all the time who, as they're going through this journey, they will start to catch themselves sliding down that, you know, greasy slide into the freakout zone. And they go, nope, shh, time out. We're okay. Nothing bad is happening. And then instead of running back to the car to go home, they keep walking. Or they say, no, I'm not going to leave the party. I'm going to hang out. And they can literally talk themselves down off the ledge with accurate information, calm, reassurance, and symptoms oftentimes will settle down. Well, what did they do? They gave themselves safety messages. So, three things: clarity, confidence, calm.
Awesome.
Calming yourself is going to be a lot easier. And calm is In other words, safety. If danger is the reason that these things are firing up, teaching yourself that you're safe is the solution. And that's about as simple as I can make it.
Relapses are a big part of the equation, I feel like, for some people, because they feel like they grasp it and then something goes awry. And then it's almost like everything that you may have learned before, suddenly you don't know anymore. I feel like, was there a couple of years ago where you went through something that lasted weeks or a month? It was kind of like with mine recently where, you know, I've had them before. I felt like everything was out. It was in control. And it went away very quickly. I didn't go and do anything extra. I just mm-hmm. went on my merry way. This past time, I didn't just go on my merry way. and subsequently, everything slowed way down in terms of recovering or feeling better. Did you have some kind of a relapse in the last couple of years that sort of, that kind of went on and on more than you would have expected or longer than you would have expected?
No, I have had two different relapses, but they did not go on and on. Mm-hmm. Each one, I think one lasted maybe 7 days, the other one about 10 days.
Okay.
And in my opinion, that's not chronic pain.
Yeah.
You know, now it was the same location, lower right back, and I did get a little bit crooked and it kind of was in that spasmy type of kind of way. And so the reason it didn't persist is because I knew exactly what it was. I called it out for exactly what it was. I checked in and I was quickly able to identify that in one case it was, you know, a relationship thing with a woman who I was dating at the time. Was able to kind of check in on that, settle in with the emotions, feel them, and then move on, right? So for me, if I get any type of a twinge, it's like, hey, what's going on emotionally, stress-wise? Yep, got it. But here's the key. I wasn't afraid of the back pain at all.
Yeah.
You know why? Because I knew what it was and I knew what to do about it. And I gave it zero attention, zero fear. And I just said, all right, well, what's going on emotionally? And then I went on with my day. And if I was limping a little bit because my sciatic and lower back was pulling me a little bit out of alignment, I didn't care. It was like, okay, whatever. As a matter of fact, the one time that it happened, I was on a business trip in Nashville with this woman, and I didn't even mention it to her. She didn't even know my back was hurting me. That's how little attention I gave it. So, yeah, it's anytime there's a flare-up, Eddie, I think the faster you can call it out for what it is, dial down the fear, know exactly that there's nothing bad happening, shift your attention back to what's going on stress-wise, emotion-wise. Allow yourself to feel it. If you've been pushing it away, allow yourself to feel it. And then go on with your day as best as you can. Now, depending upon the severity of the flare-up, that could be challenging. But staying consistent that, nope, you know, you don't go running back to Dr. Google and start researching how do herniated discs happen, and you know, you don't start diving back into that swimming pool of fear. In my case, those two instances resolved themselves fairly quickly. And I will sometimes notice if I get a little twinge by just doing the same exact thing, it's gone in 10 minutes because I give it zero fear, zero attention. I know what's going on. And that's what I suggest to people. They're like, oh no, my pain came back. I'm starting all over. No, you're not. It took me 6 years to get rid of it the first time. I'm like, yeah, it might not even take you 6 days.
Yeah.
Why? Because you can't forget what you learned the first go around. And the faster people in a setback get back to that place of calm and confidence that got rid of the pain in the first place, the faster the setback's going to go away. This is not a complete starting over. This is I hit a speed bump on this journey. Let me remember what got me better in the first place. Know that I'm fine. Calm, clarity, consistency, not freaking out. Shift your attention away from the symptoms. This is not a major problem that you now have to solve all over again, the same, you know, with the same amount of struggle that you did the first time. You know, kind of chuckle at it. It's not a big deal. And I get it when you're in the, you know, in the midst of those symptoms, because I think I remember hearing you talking about it on one of your podcasts, how the the flare-up came and kind of kicked your ass for a little while. So it's definitely disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. One of the phrases that I've heard you say quite a bit, and I'd like you to go a little bit deeper on it, is you've talked about staying out of story mode. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so one of the actual topics in my list of potentials is the difference between feeling emotions and thinking about them, right? So feeling emotions is actually experiencing it, that guttural anger, rage, guilt, shame, fear, sadness, right? You feel it in the body. Story mode is when you start thinking about all of the reasons why you're pissed off or why you're upset. That's called rumination, right? I mean, everybody knows what that is. So when I suggest to people, check in with your emotions, feel them. They're like, well, what do you mean, Dale? How do I feel my emotions? Yeah, between your chin and your gut, what are you feeling? You know, grief feels heavy in the heart. When you're choked up, you feel it in your throat, sometimes your face, right? If somebody hurts your feelings, it feels like a kick in the gut. We feel emotions in our body very often. So that's why they're called feelings. They're not called thinkings. But here's the deal. You feel the emotion so you can let it go. I don't particularly favor journaling because I think that's storytelling on paper.
Yeah.
And people will write down the story of all the reasons I'm so upset. Story, story, story. And then they'll write again the next day and the next day. And before they know it, they're like, I don't get it. My anger's not releasing. It's because you're keeping on focusing on the story. You're stuck in story mode, rumination. And every time you tell the story to yourself or anybody else, what happens? Those emotions come right back. So I think it's important to feel the emotions so that they can release. And in my world of what I'm teaching is the goal of feeling the emotions is not to discover some long-lost thing from third grade to unlock the key to this pain. The goal of feeling the emotions is to alleviate what Sarno said the problem was. The brain perceives the emotions as dangerous, and it's using something physical like pain to distract you. So if you want to short circuit that process, wouldn't it make sense to just teach the brain that, hey, these emotions are safe? Well, how do you do that? By actually feeling them, the right now stuff. So it's like exposure therapy to emotions. The more you feel them, the more your brain's going to go, wow, holy crap, look at Eddie. He's been feeling some really intense stuff lately, emotionally. I guess those things are safe. I don't need to protect him any longer with something physical like pain. It's just going right back to fundamentals from Sarno. If the brain is perceiving emotions as dangerous, what's the best way to teach the brain that they're safe? Actually feel them. And we do that by feeling them on a regular basis. I don't think that requires 30 minutes in front of a notebook. I think we can literally feel our emotions anywhere. And if you're in the middle of a family dinner and you don't want to show your emotions on your face, and next time you step into the restroom, allow yourself a couple of minutes to be present with them. Now, we do it for two reasons. One, it feels good. You ever get a good cry out or a good rage out? It feels damn good. But we also do it to teach the brain that these emotions are safe. So, I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah.
But story mode is all about rumination, and rumination is never a good way to get rid of an emotion. And we don't want to get rid of them. We want to feel them so they release automatically. Does that make sense?
It does. I love the, they're called feelings, not thinkings. I don't know if you've said that before, but I haven't heard it before.
I haven't heard it before. I don't think I've made that up. I've probably heard that somewhere else in the TMS community, so I'm not going to take credit for it.
Well, it sounds like a great tattoo. Maybe if you come out here to the Pacific Northwest, we can go get matching feelings, not thinkings tattoos. I thought about this, but you just really, shook the tree and made me think about it even more. But I often wonder, I had a dog pass away in 2019, and then I had one that we put down at the end of March. And I often have thought in the last month and a half that if I didn't have the knowledge of this stuff and feeling emotions, doing that kind of stuff, what would have happened or how would I have reacted? Meaning, how would my body have reacted if it would have happened prior to me learning about any of this stuff? Because you're right. A cry feels great in those first few days after we put Barkley down in March, if I, you know, I would sit there and ball my eyes out for 3 or 4 minutes. And yeah, it felt every single time that 20,000 pound weight that was on my back after one cry, I felt like a 16,000 pound weight was, and then, sure, you know, chipping away little by little by little and helping it happen. Do you find that, you know, I imagine the answer will be yes, but if you have any additional color, please tell me. Do you find that a lot of the people that you work with or come in contact with, that the feeling part of it is it's a big issue? It's something that they don't have practice in, they don't know how to do it, they have no, because this is another one of those things where it's simple, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy.
Well, I think that also goes back to kind of foundational. What do you know, if somebody is struggling to find or feel the emotions, foundationally, what's their perception about themselves if they feel a certain emotion? One of the things I've been talking about for years is that emotions are safe. You know, but the story I tell all the time is that, you know, for the first 30 something years of my life, I thought being angry meant I was an asshole like my father. And so what did I do with anger every time I got pissed off? I'd push it away. And the same thing holds true with sadness. You know, I had family members on my mother's side with clinical depression. And, you know, I was also told it's genetic. So I kind of believe that, well, anytime I feel sad, that means I might be slipping into mental illness like them. So I resisted that. So I think reframing it that emotions don't make us broken, bad people, damaged, crazy, out of control. They make us human. And so I've got a, you know, how to reframe emotions video that I've done a long time ago. That's just basically that. Evaluate like, for example, Eddie, what do you believe about yourself if you are in a rage? Does it mean you're a bad person? You're out of control? You're crazy? Or does it mean you're a normal human person and there's some pretty enraging stuff going on in the world? Somewhere in the middle, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, my wife, for instance, one thing that she talks about that's sort of, it's reminding me of this is, there's a bunch of kids in our neighborhood, but there's one kid in particular that really, like, her and my oldest daughter, they're either best friends or they're at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of times my daughter reacts in this very, I mean, she really gets riled up. Whereas the other girl, in almost like sociopathic style, it's weird calling a 9 year old a sociopath, but, she will just no sell it. And my daughter is like freaking out, like getting upset, running away, crying, all that kind of stuff. And my wife, one thing that she talks about with me about this is, you know, that Zoe's really kind of doing herself a disservice almost, where she's almost like overselling it. I don't know. That's one thing that came to mind when you said that.
Yeah, I think emotions are meant to be felt. Yeah, and one thing we can learn from two-year-olds is how to feel emotions. Mm-hmm. You look at a two-year-old, if they're sad, they're going to be crying. If they're angry, they're going to be stomping their feet or having a temper tantrum. If they're happy, they're going to be laughing. But watch what happens with a two-year-old. They'll get really sad. They'll cry their eyes out. And if they feel like they've been hurt, what do? They sniffle a little bit, and then they go play again. Yeah. And 5 minutes later, they're laughing and playing again. When you feel your emotions, they automatically release. You don't have to do anything fancy to release them. But those two-year-olds usually don't stay in story mode either.
Right.
They don't keep on ruminating about why they were sad that they couldn't get a cookie, you know, before dinner. They just kind of feel it, let it go, and move on. I think adults could learn a lot from that, because I don't know about you, but you know, before I knew about all this stuff, I would find myself having an argument in my head with somebody about the things I should have said and the things I'm going to say next time I see him. But I haven't even talked to him in 2 weeks.
Yep.
But yet I'm still having that argument in my head. Right? And you're laughing because
I know it's true. Yeah. Done that too. Yep.
And so I think it's just a matter of teach your brain that emotions are safe, so the brain crosses emotions off of the list of perceived dangers, period. Because Sarno's right. that can be a reason that the brain turns on the pain to protect you from these dangerous and scary emotions. So if we want the brain to stop that, well, just on a regular basis, allow yourself to notice when you're feeling quote-unquote emotional and feel whatever the heck is coming up so that your brain learns through exposure those things don't warrant protection from, and you can turn off that whole starting point. Now, that's all well and good, but if you've, over the years, become medicalized, traumatized by the medical system, now you feel that you're broken in 16 different ways, your body's a problem, the MRI, this doctor told me this or that, that's another problem to solve, which is why the accurate knowledge of what causes pain, doing the assessments, learning and teaching and calming, I mean, you got to really get on board with the fact that your body's not the issue. You know, so I don't know. The emotions are part of it, but teaching yourself that you're safe involves way more than just the emotions, because you may have all sorts of physical limitations and people in bed rest who haven't walked for, you know, besides to the bathroom, not much. So retraining your brain that you can walk safely is the challenge, and it's a process.
Yeah. There, Dr. Hanscom, this great story he told on the podcast once, because his program is kind of multifaceted and the things mm-hmm. that he teaches. But he told this really great story of this woman that had been a patient of his, or she'd been in a wheelchair for 25 years. And, you know, one of the first, like, he's got kind of this, he's got these requirements, and it led to him getting some pretty negative reviews online for a long time. But one of the things he required, people would come into his office, and he would require and mandate that for 12 weeks they don't get to talk about their pain at all. And he would make their mm-hmm. family members, the people that live in the house, come yeah. to this meeting, and he would require and mandate that nobody else ask them about their pain. Which some people would sound really harsh, but gosh, like, you know, that really gets the point across. But people would, they would just eviscerate him on online reviews because of stuff like that. But it really is, I mean, it goes back to the neuroplasticity thing, that if you're constantly just focusing on the pain, you're going to continue having that issue. But one story that he told was this woman that was in a wheelchair for 25 years and then mm-hmm. comes walking into his office after a few weeks, you know, after 12 weeks or something like that. And he was like, "What happened?" And she said, I forgave everybody. And that was it. Like, you know, these kind of miraculous stories of people that have been bedridden or have had significant physical limitations, that suddenly their, you know, their problems dissolve and their symptoms wither away with the simplest of fixes.
Yeah.
So
yeah, a good part of that, though, is how compellingly confident Dr. Hanscom likely was as he met with that patient.
Yep.
In basically convincing her and dialing her fear down that you're not broken.
Yeah.
And so people will ask, you know, how do book cures happen? Because the person who read the book and got better within a couple days, weeks, whatever, what happened? Their fear level about their body disappeared. And then they shifted their attention away from the symptoms back to life. And they had that aha moment where they were like, holy crap, I'm really not broken. And without the fear and without the attention, the brain kind of very quickly shuts it off.
Yeah.
So I don't think the book cures are common. You certainly see them. I sort of had a little bit of one, but the pain kept coming back because I had some other issues that I hadn't dealt with. So I don't think it's always that cut and dry that you can, you know, just immediately dial down the fear, because most people that come to me have been in pain for a long time and their fear levels are pretty high. So it takes a little bit of work to get them on board. But I do see people, like, you know, one lady just recently attended a group program of mine. She felt accepted, supported, like she was among peers who get it and understand it, where her family just doesn't understand what she's going through. She felt completely supported. She felt confident. Her fear level dropped. She just posted a post in the Facebook group for this private group, a picture of her riding her bike.
Yeah.
She hadn't ridden her bike in years. And it's like, wow, amazing. So it's amazing what clarity and dialing down the fear can do. and also feeling supported. Whereas a lot of the family members of people who have been dealing with this for a long time, they're at their wit's end. They don't know how to help, and they're just frustrated, and that really creates a cycle at home that is tough to overcome.
The last, as we're circling here at the end, kind of thinking about this chronologically, is there any, and maybe we've touched on some of this stuff throughout the interview, but one thing that I often think about is, again, on the topic of relapses or people that have experienced it that don't want to go back to it and that kind of thing. And I know a lot of it is dialing down the fear, which is what you've talked about. Mm-hmm. What would you say is a good rest? You know, we talked earlier, what are three things that somebody that's just not getting it, what can they do? What can they think about? What are they overlooking? And one additional thing, maybe as a, you know, as a dessert to that is, what are some things that maybe you would say, maybe one or two things, not like a maintenance plan per se, but just some stuff to keep in mind, or maybe not a daily practice, but something just to consider with regularity, or consider doing with regularity, or thinking about with regularity, or anything like that. Again, the neuroplasticity idea and repetition and that kind of stuff, which I think is important, because I'm one of the people that I don't want to be doing a journaling program for the rest of my life. I don't want to be doing meditation every day for the rest of my life. And some people, that works great for them. But, you know, you and I sound very similar in that we don't necessarily want, I'd much rather go spend, if I'm going to drop 20 minutes a day to do something, I'd rather take my dog on a second walk or go play fetch with him or with her or whatever. What about something like that? Like a maintenance idea.
I mean, I literally did a video maybe a week ago. How do I stop TMS from coming back? And my answer for me is I have no daily routine whatsoever. And the core concepts of my message are, teach your brain emotions are safe by feeling them. Teach yourself that you're safe physically by not walking around tight. You ever see yourself in the mirror and your shoulders are up and you're everything is tight and you're kind of holding your breath? That screams danger. Well, if we can become more habitual in relaxing our body, that sends a direct message to the brain subconsciously that I'm safe. So emotions are safe by feeling them. Physically, I'm safe by having a relaxed body, because if you're afraid and hurting, you're not in a relaxed body. So if we can just get habitual to notice when we're tense, relax so that you can breathe normally, that handles that. The last part is not taking our own thinking seriously. Oh, I got a twinge. Instead of letting your thoughts drag you down into that rabbit hole of fear and freak out, just be like, no, I know what it is. The things that help you get rid of the pain become who you are. I'm just a guy who allows myself to feel my emotions, relax my body. People are like, oh, Dan, you're so chill. I'd be chill if I lived in front of those woods too, right? And people assume I've got no stress, which is kind of BS. I got tons of stress. You know what it's like to get 20 messages a day from people going, Dan, please help me, right? You know what that's like. You've gotten them. And so I've got just as much stress as I ever have, but I don't have chronic symptoms because I've taught myself that stress is not dangerous, emotions are not dangerous, that I'm safe physically, right? I don't have any fears about pain, because I'm so clear. And that blows some people away because they're like so suggestible. Oh, I don't want to hear about anybody else's pain because next thing I know, I'll have their pains too. Right? That's all just driven by fear. Oh no, somebody with back pain got leg pain. Oh no, I hope I don't get leg pain. Next thing they know, they've got it.
Yep.
So if that's not proof of the brain creating it, nothing is, you know?
Yeah, when Steve Ozanich was on here, he was talking about that specific thing, and he was talking about somebody he had spoken with about elbow pain. And as he's talking about it, I bring it up and I'm like, you know, my elbow it's kind of bugging me, just like literally since he had just started talking about it 3 minutes earlier, and then it receded. But totally correct.
Yeah, what's funny is last February 2021, I started feeling a little bit of weird pressure in my head bending over. I was like, I don't know what that is, but that's weird. Sure enough, within that week or two, I did a private coaching call with somebody with persistent headaches. Well, you know what happened to me? I started to get persistent headaches bending over, which was interesting. I was like, what the heck? Come to find out, it was a good thing because I got checked out and I had a major cyst blocking my right sinuses. So that was probably equating to the pressure. So I got that removed. And of course, you know, the pain was just TMS. Yeah. So I no longer have persistent headaches. But it was funny how just the suggestibility of, you know, feeling head pressure when bending over, combined with hearing a story of somebody with persistent headaches, next thing I knew, I had some.
Yeah.
So I got dealt with physically. I got a surgery last April to deal with the cyst. And then even though the headaches persisted for a little while, I was able to teach my brain, hey, nope, cyst is gone. No reason. You got the MRI. Your head's clear. No aneurysms, no tumors. You're good. And so, you know, it's interesting how the brain is very suggestible that way, but it doesn't have to be. And understanding exactly what causes pain, the perceived danger, in my opinion, helps you really just identify and go, all right, well, I've got pain today. I don't know why. My brain must be perceiving something as dangerous. And if I can find it, obviously, great. But if I can't, it doesn't matter. We can shift immediately towards safety to go to the brain. Hey, brain, shh, nothing bad's happening. I didn't fall. I didn't get hit by a bus. Nothing bad occurred. We can turn this off because nothing dangerous is happening. Go immediately to safety, teach the brain, and the brain gets a message. It can go away and stay away.
Dan, where can people learn more about you?
Painfreeyou.com. There's a video on the homepage. There's a, you know, get help menu option. And the first part in the get help menu option is a page I created recently called Getting Started. And that start page kind of walks you through the whole thing. It's like, what creates pain? You know, and here's two different assessments where you can determine, does this apply to me? So that's getting the foundation out right away. It's not even behind an opt-in. You don't have to give an email or anything. Just go to the Getting Started menu. And that'll give you the foundational knowledge. And then I give, you know, both some free options for getting help as well as, you know, some paid options.
Awesome. Dan, thanks so much for joining us and coming back. And I'm sure we'll do this again and it'll be less than 3 years plus one day.
In another 6 months, right?
Yeah, let's do it another 6 months.
I'll talk to you in 2025.
Yeah, no kidding. Dan Buglio, hey, thanks for joining us.
Eddie, I appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, take care.
All right, man.